Omar Musa is the creator of 5 hip-hop records, 4 books of poetry, an award-winning one-man show, 2 novels, the most recent one of which, Fierceland, received the 2026 Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Fiction, and he also creates and exhibits woodcut prints. Omar grew up in Queanbeyan, though in more recent years he's lived in places like New York and Borneo, which is where Fierceland is set. Omar Musa, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
How's it going?
Omar, could we start by hearing a little bit about your family and what it was like growing up in Queanbeyan?
Yeah, I'm very proudly from Queanbeyan. It's a really beautiful place. I don't think I realised that until later in life because, you know, people always making fun of Queanbeyan, saying it was struggle town or like, you know, it was the town that was dug and not built and all that type of thing. You know, I think maybe in my younger days, I was like, yeah, I'm from Queanbeyan, I'm from struggle town, I'm from the hood or whatever. And then as I grew older, I was like, no, it's actually just like a really beautiful town on a river surrounded by nature and a really interesting blend of, you know, different people from around the world and Aboriginal people. And I grew up in a flat block there with my parents, my dad from East Malaysia, from Borneo, and my mum from Forbes, New South Wales. And I was very lucky to have grown up there.
And so what was your early life like? Were you happy as a young kid in Queanbeyan?
Oh, wow. What a question. Yeah, I think I actually had quite a happy childhood. I was an only child, so I think I grew up feeling a sense of loneliness. So I think that makes some people really introverted and others really extroverted. And for me, it was the latter. So I always was out there looking to engage with the world and make friends and find camaraderie. But I was alone a lot of the time, you know, so I'd have to find things to preoccupy myself. So being from an artistic family with a mother who had been a theatre director and an arts journalist and a father who was a poet and an actor earlier in life, I sort of was drawn to the arts, to drawing, to writing poetry. And yeah, I guess I always had a bit of a heaviness in my heart from a young age. I'm not exactly sure why, but I found the world around me very, very confusing and quite heavy. And so I think it was through writing poetry and drawing that I was able to in some way maybe make sense of it or I guess alchemize it in some way.
Omar, could you tell us a little bit about your parents' story? You said your mum was from Forbes, your dad from Malaysia. How did they meet?
Yeah, so my mum had been heavily involved in the theatre in Sydney for a long time. And she got the chance to go and work at the University of Science Malaysia in Penang. And she was put in charge of directing the first ever Malay language version of William Shakespeare's Hamlet. And they were going to put on this amazing production in an old British fort next to the sea and kind of incorporate Malay and Chinese ghost stories and everything like that. But they're having a really hard time casting the lead role until this smooth, handsome young fella from Sandakan in Borneo, who had been a romance radio DJ and was a bit of a mysterious kind of character, sort of walked through the door and got the role of Hamlet. And so my father was the first Malaysian Hamlet. And then, of course, he went on to the way more prestigious role of being my father.
So was Malaysia and Borneo sort of really on your map and in your head as a young boy? Did you go back there early on?
Yeah, for sure. I grew up speaking Malay. My mother, even though she's, you know, Irish-Australian, she speaks fluent Malay and Indonesian. And so I grew up speaking the language in the house and just surrounded by stories of their life there and of my father's life growing up in a small water village called Simsim, which is just on the edge of Sandakan, which is, you know, a place famous to Australians because of World War II and the death marches. But for my father and for my family, it was just, you know, it was where they grew up. And so I suppose there was an early period in my life when I'd experienced a fair bit of racism at school. And I don't remember this, but my mum did say to me that when I was maybe about 8 or 9 years old, I came home once and I said that I wished I wasn't brown anymore and that I wished I wasn't different from the other kids. I don't remember that, but when I was 9 years old, and I don't know if it was connected, my dad took me on quite a long trip back to Malaysia and back to Borneo to connect with my family, my grandparents. My grandmother is actually an amazing poet, even though she never learned how to read or write. She's from a tribe of women called the Kadayan tribe who are famous for improvising poetry. So I kind of connected with that side of my family. My dad's one of 9, so I had heaps of cousins around. And that was just a really formative thing for me. And And I guess when I came back, having improved language skills and being connected, ever since that, I do remember that I was really proud of my heritage and I identified not just as Australian, but as Malaysian Australian.
You mentioned that you were writing poetry from early on. How young were you when you started writing poetry?
Man, well, I always loved stories, but I think I probably would have been about maybe in like year five. I had a teacher, and this is often the case, isn't it? Like that you have an English teacher that really encourages you with whatever it is that ends up being your passion. I had a teacher called Ms. Leanne Patterson, and shout out to her if she's listening in. She probably is, actually. And she noticed from a young age that I was drawn to telling stories, but I'd write these really gory horror stories. Like I was really drawn to the darkness, which I probably still am. But she started feeding us a lot of poetry that was probably beyond our years, even stuff like T.S. Eliot, John Donne. Everyone else thought poetry was really boring and stale and they didn't want to do it. But I remember I was really into it immediately. And I started writing these little poems that I think I thought were like diary entries. But my parents and Ms. Patterson were just like, oh, wow, this is something you're really into and that you're really good at. And so it kind of became my thing, you know. But then as I started getting older, even though that was my thing, I wanted to connect with my friends in Queanbeyan, but they just were like just not interested in poetry, you know. And so I guess I was looking for a form of poetry that was lived and performed, because my dad always said that in Malaysia and Indonesia, poetry was at its best when it's performed. And I didn't see it around me, you know, in Australia at that time, until I came across hip hop music in my early teens. And then I realized that, yeah, that was the sort of poetry that I wanted to make.
Well, from what you said about your grandmother, improvising and performing poetry was in the blood, no doubt about that. But when did you get into hip hop as a performer, and also something you became very, very well known for, slam poetry?
Oh, yeah. You know what? I'm of an age where like Australian hip hop, when I was growing up, was still really on the fringes. And people would make fun of you for rapping in your own accent and everything like that. There was that big debate about, you know, American versus Aussie accent. And so I didn't actually have the confidence until I left high school to really get into rapping. I was probably like 18, 19 when I started really writing raps. I think it was in my early 20s that I got into slam poetry. Like I'd seen a little bit of it before. It hadn't been something that I'd really necessarily want to get into, but there was a dude that I went to uni with at ANU called Julian Fleetwood, and he was putting on a bunch of slam poetry events at a place called the Front Cafe in Lynham in Canberra. And he, I think, didn't have enough people to make up the numbers. So he knew that rappers were good to invite because, you know, we memorize our lyrics. Like you don't get up there with a piece of paper. And so he invited me to come along. And I remember I did this rap just without the music, all about the Cronulla riots. And then I think I won that slam. And so I was kind of, it piqued my interest, you know, and I really enjoyed the fact that people were listening so closely to these lyrics that I'd agonized over for ages, and I'd found a new audience, I guess.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with poet, hip-hop artist, novelist, one-man show performer and woodcut printer Omar Musa. And Omar, I had the good fortune to see you at TEDx Sydney, and you really took that crowd by storm. It was a rousing standing ovation, and that, I suppose, gives a sense of the way you can captivate audiences. When you think back to your performances as a slam poet, is there a particular performance that's special to you in your heart in terms of the way you both performed and were able to connect with an audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think doing that poem about Queanbeyan and about growing up in Queanbeyan and on the main stage of the Sydney Opera House was a really massive moment for me, because, you know, poetry, it still is seen as a very fringe art form. It's on the outside. There's no money in it. You know, it's not necessarily seen as cool or lucrative or anything like that. And I think that's actually why it's so special in a way, because poetry will endure, it will persist. But I think it is meant to be kind of hovering around on the fringes, observing what's going on in the dominant society, not necessarily being a part of it. Having said that, being able to perform poetry on that stage about a small town that I come from, that I'm proud of, that so many of us, we grow up in towns like this. Like oftentimes what's mythologized in Australia, you know, is this kind of coastal idyll or something, you know, that's in the outback. But really, so many of us grow up in these suburban towns, oftentimes places that are seen as a bit dull or mundane. But actually, the stories that are going on there are just so rich and so full of life that I wanted to celebrate that. And getting the chance to do that in 2013 was just huge to me.
You say that you weren't in poetry for the money, clearly. So is that why you moved to novels? Were you in novels for the money, Omar?
Definitely not. And even if I was, then I was barking up the wrong tree with that one.
So what made you turn to the novel as a form?
Just loving stories. You know, being a storyteller, being a nerdy little kid, loving reading books. It always had seemed like almost like a bucket list thing that I'd wanted to do ever since I was a kid. But I didn't know how to do it. And so when I won the Australian Poetry Slam in 2007 or 8, I forget, part of the prize was going to the Ubud Readers and Writers Festival in Bali, which was huge because that was kind of the first time I was like flying overseas to do my poetry. And I was just really intrigued by the novelists. I'd like always go up and start chatting to them and asking how they did it because it just seemed like this gargantuan canvas on which to paint a story. And so, yeah, I kind of got it in my head that maybe one day I'd be able to do that. But in a way, I sort of hustled or talked my way into it because I'd finished a hip-hop record and I was being interviewed on Triple R in Melbourne by a lady named Sophie Cunningham, who's an amazing writer and was a sort of legendary publisher. And she was like, okay, you finished your rap album. What are you working on now? And I'd actually written probably about 5 pages in this weird combination of like a bit of an Aussie Irvine Welsh style, you know, meets Dorothy Porter poetry prose thing. But I hadn't really written that much, but I kind of talked it up because I knew that she was in publishing. And then off air, she was like, wow, that sounds really fascinating. Can you show me something? And I was like, oh yeah, look, it's not in good enough shape at the moment, but I'll get back to you in a few weeks. And so I went off and I just wrote furiously for a whole month. And I wrote what ended up being the first 4 chapters of my first novel, Here Come the Dogs, which was, well, I never said it was about Queanbeyan, but it was, you know, heavily inspired by the lives of kind of powerless, angry young men in a place like Queanbeyan and hip hop culture and combustible race relations. And then I sort of painted myself into a corner because I got myself a publishing deal. And all of a sudden I had to produce this novel and I didn't know what I was doing, you know, so it was quite stressful, but I guess I've been learning on the job ever since.
Well, you certainly got there. Here Come the Dogs came out in 2014 and you mentioned the inspiration of Irvine Welsh, author famously of Trainspotting, amongst many other titles. And he called your debut novel stunning and described you as having swaggering exuberance. When you look back on Here Come the Dogs now, what are your thoughts on, you know, where you were as a writer and as an artist when you put that out?
Yeah, I'm really proud of it because I've never been somebody that had a lot of discipline and it took a lot of discipline to accomplish even just finishing the novel and getting it out there. But of course, there are certain things I look back on and it wasn't very polished. It was full of rage and I think it had a certain type of energy because of that. Some of it makes me a bit uneasy because I was at a different point in my life. You know, I can sort of see or read the torment that I was in as a person. I've lived with addiction and alcoholism for a long period of time. And while I was writing that, that was the case, even though I didn't know it, or maybe wouldn't admit it to myself. And so it is almost like reading the thoughts of a completely different person, even though I can obviously see myself in it. And there's some stuff in it that's dated, but then there are other things that are sadly still true, you know, especially some of the meditations on toxic masculinity, you know, a toxic masculinity that I was conditioned by as a young man. And I would say race relations in Australia, a country that has not been able to deal with its past and has a certain type of amnesia that means that it's not able to flourish or grow into the future, I think. And so, yeah, I guess when I look back on it, it makes me a little bit uneasy, but I'm sort of trying to give myself a bit of grace with it as well and be proud of what I did with that book.
Fair enough. You describe the prose as full of rage. Were you full of rage too? And what about?
I think I've always been filled with a certain type of fury for sure since I was a young kid. Some of it, I guess, is born from a sense of powerlessness or confusion growing up in between cultures. As I mentioned before, experiencing racism in the schoolyard, seeing things around me that didn't make sense, you know, in Queanbeyan, drug use and domestic violence. But then I think also post September 11, a different type of rage came out of me. And that was born from realizing that when I saw Muslim people on television being demonized and told that they were the enemy, and then realizing that I was also being spoken about in that same breath, and realizing that you are seen as the existential threat to Australia, somebody unwanted and to be kicked out with all that kind of F off, we're full mentality and rhetoric that became so commonplace. Yeah, I think I didn't have too many tools in my toolkit to deal with that. And so when I reached for an emotion, it was usually anger.
Omar, you mentioned Islam, and in your song, Too Hard to Say, you touch on the influence that religion's had on you as an artist and as a person.
They don't get it. You can't just wave a wand and then like sleight of hand, that part of you is gone. It's not as simple as that. Religion is culture, and culture enwraps all the parts of yourself that you didn't even know were there. The way I make poems like prayers, I learn it from the preachers, the way they do speeches.
You refer to parts of yourself that you didn't even know were there. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about your relationship to Islam over the years and where you're at with it these days.
Yeah, it's a big question. I mean, I grew up in a really religious household, and I always had a pretty complex and maybe even tortured relationship with Islam. And I was proud of it, but there often felt like there was a spiritual block within me when I was trying to engage with it. And then, as you say, I came to realize that I was influenced and conditioned in so many ways, so many good ways, by my relationship with Islam. For instance, Islam's egalitarianism, and it's a religion that seeks equality and justice. And I think that's something that, I mean, I haven't always lived up to, but I've tried to keep in my mind when making work. And then things like poetry. The Quran is written in poetry. Poetry in Islamic history is something that has often been revered, a means of expression and trying to seek out some form of ecstasy or divine connection. And I think that even in my days when I pushed Islam away, I was seeking some form of quasi-religious incandescence through my poetry that I think was informed by my religious upbringing. But at the same time, I did push it away because I felt that in a lot of ways, maybe because of a complex relationship with my father, it had been kind of pushed on me. And so I've sort of taken a pretty long and meandering route back to it. And now I've got quite a private religious and spiritual practice. And I'm a lot more comfortable with talking about it and living it. And I think maybe for years and years, because of some of those struggles I had with addiction and alcoholism, I felt like maybe I was a bad Muslim and a bad representation of that in a country that already was sort of demonizing and dehumanizing Muslim people. And so, yeah, I struggled with that because I was super proud of my identity, but I was also in a lot of torment.
Mm. It's perhaps no surprise, given the way you've just spoken about your relationship with Islam, that you were inspired by Muhammad Ali as well. And your one-man show was about Ali and your relationship with him. Could you speak a little bit about that, Omar?
Yeah, well, I was talking a bit before about how I'd had some bullying in the schoolyard, and I had told my parents that I wished I wasn't brown anymore, which is, you know, imagine that. Like, imagine that type of internalizing, that type of hatred. It could throw you off course or ruin you for life and your whole sense of selfhood. And unfortunately, you know, I think Australia does struggle so much with racism. And so imagine all the people out there who have similarly internalized that type of hate. But around that time when I said that, I remember my parents sat me down and they kind of said, look, you shouldn't speak this way. You should be proud of your heritage. You should be proud of where you're from and your background, proud of being Muslim. And my dad started to show me these tapes of a handsome, charismatic boxer from the States, Muhammad Ali, who was self-proclaimed he was the greatest, he was the prettiest, and he said black was beautiful, and I just loved him. I absolutely adored him. And it's kind of funny to look back on it now, because I was like a nerdy kind of, you know, middle-class Asian kid with my hair parted in the middle and glasses, and wasn't particularly good at sport, just a world away from America and from what he was talking about. But like so many people around the world, you know, I felt like he was speaking to me, and it gave me this sense of pride and strength, and also the fact that he was Muslim and proud of it. Because when I looked around at that time, there weren't any Muslim people in public life in Australia. So I kind of had to look abroad. And then in some ways, because of the way that he spoke and rhymed, he was like a proto rapper. I think it kind of got me into that side of things as well, a little bit more. So he's like the only celebrity person that I didn't know personally, that when he died, I was shattered. You know, I was just inconsolable. Like I couldn't stop crying, because it felt, it's cliche to say, but you know, it felt like a part of me had died, or like a part of my childhood. And then I was pretty, you know, pretty chaotic and addled at the time. Like I remember thinking like, oh, I had this relationship and it fell apart. And then one of my friends passed away, and then Brexit happened and Trump got elected. And I was like, oh, it's all because Muhammad Ali died. I was like, he was the string that was binding everybody together and the whole world together, you know. But it could equally have been, you know, David Bowie. Maybe it was like, maybe I should have written since Bowie died instead of since Ali died.
Omar, of all the creative pursuits you've taken up, so many of them are to do with the artistry of the word, but the one that in a way stands out is woodcutting. How did you come to woodblock carving and printing?
I've always been into drawing and visual art. I would connect with my Aussie grandma through drawing. But I guess at a certain point, I just started following the words, and I thought that that was my thing, and I didn't make visual art. But I was having a bit of a dark night of the soul, actually around that time when I was, you know, made that play Since Ali Died. And I went on a river journey in Borneo to the heart of the island, taking the public ferry, sleeping on the deck. And I saw a lot of amazing wood carving while I was up the river, you know, like every tribe in Borneo, whether you're an interior tribe or from the hills or from the coastline, like my ancestors, all of them are amazing at carving wood because it was once the most heavily forested island in the world. And so in some ways, I do think it flows in people's bloodline. But I got to that point where I really hated what I thought I was supposed to be passionate about, writing, performing. And that really swept the rug out from underneath me, because I was just like, well, who am I, you know? And so while I was on that river journey, I realized that I needed to find a new way of expressing myself. And I don't know if maybe subconsciously I saw all the wood carving and I thought that might be something I'd do. But a few weeks later, I was back in Malaysian Borneo, and I was I attended a workshop by a local punk rocker called Arik Lost Control. And that's not... It's not his government name. His real name's Arik Tan. And he was this wild character. And he taught me how to carve the wood block, roll it with ink, and then press it to paper and cloth by dancing on it with my feet and us playing music, playing guitar, reciting poetry to give it more samangat, you know, more spirit, they say. And I just became obsessed. I was sort of freed, I guess, because I'd started to put so much pressure on myself to be quote unquote good, or to write something deep or profound, that I think I'd lost that kind of playful element that you need to make good art, even if it's about serious subject matter. And so suddenly getting into wood carving, where nobody, including myself, expected me to be any good at it, I could be like a kid again and start just creating stuff for the fun of it, creating beautiful things after being just so preoccupied with the darkness of human nature and the darkness within myself. Then slowly I started combining the woodcut prints with poetry, and then I eventually had my first exhibition that I put on probably within about 4 months of making my first woodcut. I had an exhibition at the Lord Gladstone in Sydney, and it sort of freaked me up, and it led me back into making music and writing again. Oh, and also I guess it helped me connect with my culture. That was the other thing. Just like the poetry years ago, it was connecting me into a long lineage of people who carved wood, because even my uncle on the palm oil plantation, he would carve these amazing little objects and toys, and no one had taught him how to do that. It was just in him.
Omar, what year have you chosen as the year that made you?
I've got the worst memory, so I didn't want to go back too far. So I chose 2023. It was the year that I moved to New York City. It was the year that I met my wife, Mariel. It was also the year that I lost my best friend, who was tragically killed a few years ago. And so, that year was all the highs and lows that you can experience in life, you know, love, loss, grief, and then grief on a grand scale with the genocide in Gaza. And so, yeah, it's a year I'll never forget, because I just remember people asking me, oh, how's New York? How's life? And I'd say, man, it's like, it's simultaneously the best year of my life, but the worst thing that's ever happened to me is also. So it was like, really, it was confusing.
That is a lot to go on in 12 months. Let's break it down a little bit. Why did you move to New York?
I think after the pandemic, I just wanted to explore and find a new home somewhere. And so I thought that was going to be Borneo. But a friend of mine asked me if I wanted to go and cat sit Pancake the Ginger Tabby in Brooklyn. And I was like, hell yeah, I'll go and look after a cat and work on my novel. And so I was in Brooklyn, and I'd never really thought I'd end up in New York. And then a mutual friend of myself and the lady who would end up being my wife invited me to a performance of hers. She's an amazing cellist. And I looked at the invitation, and it was, you know, something about experimental cello music. And I was like, man, I don't know if this is really my vibe. But then I thought to myself, you know what? I'm coming out of my shell. I need to go and experience new things. And so I went across from Brooklyn to Manhattan. Yeah, and I walked in the door and I saw the cellist, and I was struck immediately by her. I was like, oh, damn. Like, because look, I'll just say that the bio made me expect somebody different. So I walked through and I was just like, oh, man, the cellist is stunning. And then we had this good little conversation, and she was just super friendly and sweet. But then when she started performing, it was this whole different person. There was sort of this real physicality and kind of aggression and something, I don't know, very intense and furious about the way she performs. And I was like, there's layers to this person, you know, and I was immediately pretty intrigued. And so after the set, everyone was sort of gathered around, you know, lavishing her with praise. And I was just, you know, hanging around at the back trying to figure out how I could get her number. And I didn't have the guts. So I went outside into the cold New York night, and I was just standing there going like, man, I'm a coward. Like, why couldn't I go up and get a number? Like, what the hell? And I was about to leave. And just at that moment, she walked out of the building with her cello strapped to her back. And she was like, oh, hey, it was really nice to meet you. You know, I'd love to check out your work sometime. And again, I messed it up. You know, I wasn't able to get the number, and she walked away, and I could just see the cello, like, strapped to her back, getting smaller and smaller, like disappearing. There was all the shreds of smoke coming up from the subway. She was about to turn around the corner, and I was like, ah, screw it, you only live once. And so I like ran after her and asked her for a number, asked her out for a ramen, and then that was it.
But obviously 2023 was also marked by tragedy, the loss of your friend B, and you dedicate your latest book, Fierce Land, to the memory of B.
Yeah.
If you're okay with it, Omar, could you speak a little about B, your friendship with them, and the loss of B?
Yeah. It's hard to know where to start. We met in high school. He was from a small community up in Cape York called Arakoon, but then came down to Canberra, I think when he was about 10 years old, to live with his dad. And he was a really incredible, beautiful, charismatic, smart, cheeky, but also quite troubled guy who had a lot of pressure on his shoulders from many different sides. Grew up in between worlds. He was somebody who, you know, he drove me crazy. He was my best mate. He was like my brother. We'd argue and fight all the time. But he really was like my brother. You know, I think I mentioned before I was an only child, and I did see him as the brother that I'd never had. So he was kind of a special person. And we, you know, troubled a lot. He was a leader in his community. He did a lot of incredible things up there with like a rangers program, carbon crediting, moving people back onto country. He was very eloquent speaker. Yeah, anyone who met him, they never forgot him. I'm actually looking at a photo of him right now, and he's just this really dazzling smile. But yeah, in 2023, I got a call from his brother. And when I saw his brother's name pop up, I think I just knew, you know, I just knew he'd sort of, yeah, he was a little bit tormented. And I got the news that he had tragically been killed. And I guess these sorts of things, you know, grief is so heavy because grief is also love. And it's so entwined. And I loved him really. I loved him dearly. And I really miss him.
Thanks for speaking about that, Omar. You obviously came back to writing novels, but it sounds like Fierce Land was a bit longer in the generation than your first work, which obviously you just had to knock out really quickly because you told someone you'd already written it.
Yeah.
Tell us about the generation of Fierce Land, a little bit of what it's about and what it means to you.
Yeah, sure. I think after writing Here Come the Dogs, that dealt with Australian society and was sort of inspired by Queanbeyan, I knew that I wanted to turn my attentions and my gaze back towards my origins and towards the archipelago of Southeast Asia. I'd originally thought I was going to write a type of seafaring, borderless novel. I think I took that spirit of borderlessness, but then I decided to focus on the forest and on the dark, corrupt world of palm oil, exploitation, extraction, and Borneo, in particular Malaysian Borneo, where my dad comes from. So the genesis of the idea came probably before I finished Here Come the Dogs, actually, but it went through so many iterations. And eventually I landed upon this relationship between a daughter and a father. And the daughter is trying to grapple with the father's ghost and with his legacy. Some of it, which is very revered because he's this kind of rags to riches success story in modern Malaysia. But a lot of it is also very dark and violent because as the book proceeds, you realize that while he's revered, the father was also potentially responsible for the disappearance of people who stood in his way. And so it's about ghosts, really. I've described it as a ghost story, and the ghosts are the ghosts of family members, the ghosts of the forests that have been destroyed all over Southeast Asia, but also the ghosts of languages and the ghosts of colonialism and how they continue to haunt us.
Omar, it's been great speaking with you for The Year That Made Me. You have created such a wide range of artistic output. Do you know what's next for you?
Yeah, I've got a new book of short stories coming out through Penguin Random House Australia in July. And, you know, I don't want to talk it up, but I think it's probably got the best title in the history of Australian literature. It's called The Vape Lord of Queanbeyan, and I'm very proud of it. I actually am just handing you my final edits today. So yeah, I've got the book of short stories. I've been working on a new book of poetry. I've got a bit of a hyperactive mind. So there's always something around the corner to be working on.
Well, something tells me that somewhere along the lines, the keys to the city of Queanbeyan are going to be part of it as well. Omar, thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us, Omar, and why?
I've chosen a song that my wife, Mariel, introduced me to in 2023 called Gracias a la Vida by the amazing Chilean poet and songwriter Violeta Parra. And I believe it means thanks to life. And thought it was a good one to end on when we're talking about life and love and grief and all the highs and lows. Because despite it all, despite some of the dark places that we go to, I'm still really, really thankful to be able to explore this beautiful life and to connect with good people and find new art forms and see new things and hear new music.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.